The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
Welcome back to the programme. And we have been joined now by Stephen O'Leary, who's a media analyst at Olitico and lecturer in online journalism with Griffith College. Now, there was a big event this week, a News Academy event held in Croke Park. I think that's what you were talking about earlier on, or maybe it
wasn't.
No,
I was talking about a separate event. It was the Association of European Journalists.
All right. In the okay. And at that, anyway, the founder of Storyful, Mark Little, was criticising some of the media hype and TV coverage that came in the wake of the missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. He said the Malaysia Airline disaster was a simple story where there was no video, no real facts, and there was nothing to support a lot of the discussions that were taking place. But because there were ratings for them, they just kept talking and filling in gaps with baseless speculation. What do you think of that, Stephen?
I think there's a lot of truth to it, unfortunately. I mean, a lot of people have talked about this as a breaking news story, but it wasn't. It was breaking speculation. After about 48 hours, no new credible news was added to this. But what we've seen, not just in the UK and Ireland, but across the world, and I think particularly in the US, is there is a huge battle for ratings. And what this, particularly I think on CNN, we've seen this actually just take over.
CNN have gone very big on it. I mean, with hour-long documentaries, you don't expect hour-long documentaries that often.
But it's not just hour-long. This is literally 24/7 now. And the problem is every show is talking about it. And it's as if nothing else is happening in the world. And lots of other things are happening in the world at the moment. And I think that's probably one of the most shocking things about the amount of coverage this is getting. It's not as if there is no other news to report on. There was some really sort of strong points made during the week about the mudslide that happened in Washington, where 10 people were killed, the ongoing situation in the Ukraine and Crimea, the G8 becoming the G7 for a meeting. You know, there were huge, huge incidents, even down to there was a massive oil problem in Houston, hundreds of miles of coastline damaged, and none of it was covered. Instead, CNN stuck to just covering this thing. And the problem is, the counter-argument to it is, they're getting the ratings. So their ratings have literally doubled in the last couple of weeks. And commercially, that's probably what's driving the decision to continue reporting in this kind of way.
Is that because there is just an appetite beyond belief in imagining this story in a funny way, I suppose, because we all go through airports at one stage or another?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, we hear about this term closure and we want to know what has happened. I mean, I think absolutely the fact that so many people use air travel now, there is that element of fear and could this happen again? But it's not the first time it's happened. You know, planes have gone missing in the past. We know that there is that outside chance that something like this will happen. I think one of the critical things in this story is that in the past, when someone went missing or when something went missing, we weren't able to track things in the way we can now. We know from the NSA revelations and various other things in the news over the last couple of years that we can be tracked down to a millimetre. Almost all the time people know where we are and what we're doing.
That's why, I mean, if you take the messing that went on in the early days of this, I mean, I am advised that various military systems would have tracked that from day one, but mightn't have wanted their neighbours to know what kind of surveillance systems they had.
Yeah, and I think there definitely is. That's the disbelief. And I think that's what it comes back to. People are saying, well, look, we can track almost everything. We can find things whenever we need to find them. We have all this information. How is it possible that an airplane can disappear out of the sky and we have absolutely no trace at all? I have an element of sympathy, though, too. I mean, I think the Malaysian government have taken a real hammering in this. And I think, you know, particularly I think to do with sort of the way they've broken news in some situations. So a lot of people talked about the issue of sending text messages. And I talked to a few people about this during the week. And actually what they said was that really beyond a text message, how else are you going to, in this breaking news world that we live in, get that news out to so many people in a way
simultaneously.
And actually I think, you know, it probably on reflection was the best way or the most appropriate way to get it, so that you didn't have a family who got information 2 minutes before another.
Mind you, it feels a very cold thing to hear about a death on a text message. What do you think, Harry? I mean, there is a certain validity to all of this. There, and I know that the 24-hour news channels, you know, it's a great big monster looking for material day in, day out. But there was material.
There was. I mean, if you look at the... I mean, there were no new facts in relation to the disappearance itself, but there was the reluctance of military authorities to disclose information, and that information came out in dribs and drabs. And then there was a growing anger of the families. But was I think the net point that Mark Little was making was that tantamount to the blanket coverage it got? Because when you added up the sum total of the facts that emerged, did it justify the blanket coverage? And it seems to me this goes to the nature of media coverage these days. It's a 24-hour news cycle, and this whole concept of a rolling story, in which a story evolves as a narrative. It goes back to the O.J. Simpson car chase with the cameras and the helicopter following it, and new nuggets of information coming in. And for example, the best example of it at present is the Oscar Pretorius trial in South Africa, where there's different things happening by the hour, by the minute. That's covered on Twitter. It's covered by live TV, and it's covered by websites. The difficulty is that sometimes the material isn't there to sustain the rolling news coverage. So you have the phenomenon, for example, when there's a big weather story, you'll have a Sky reporter standing in a puddle of rain in the southwest of England somewhere for 2 days telling you basically the same information over and over again. And there's a difficulty there. But then there are the pressures of modern journalism as well. Nick Davis, a very famous English journalist, has described it as churnalism, where people are just churning out facts. So there seems to be less and less time for reflection or contemplation or analysis, and just more and more geared towards kind of this breathless dissemination of news. I think there's a problem inherent in that.
Richard? Well, I mean, it's definitely a terrible, tragic story, but it's the gift that keeps on giving, in a sense. There's no closure on it. Nobody's really quite sure what happened. My own view, I suspect, is that the crew were overtaken by fumes and everyone died and the plane just flew in whatever direction it was going in. But, obviously in the South Indian Ocean. But the situation is big. People are fascinated by air travel. A lot of people are terrified of air travel.
Yeah.
So you were pressing a lot of buttons there in relation to whatever coverage you did. And it was a bit like a latter day. At one stage, for about 10 days, it was like a latter day Marie Celeste. The plane had disappeared. Nobody knew where it was. So in terms of 24-hour news coverage, it was an ideal story for them, because I think as I know what Mark Little said,
there was no news, but it just
meant that people could stand in front of a camera and give their latest piece of speculation. And of course everyone then drilled into the background history of the pilots and all this kind of thing. So I think it's just that people are fearful in some ways of air travel, and it's ideal for them in the sense that if you're covering a story like that, it there's a fear factor into it. Oh, this might happen to me. I think at any one time there's some like 350,000 people in the air.
Well, I saw a picture the other night of the sky over, I can't remember what city it was, and dear Lord of heaven, the amount of activity going on. What do you say to your students about this kind of thing?
I suppose we talk about a level of responsibility and purpose as well. I mean, you know, are you genuinely adding to the conversation in a meaningful way? You know, there's the ratings question is a difficult one, because increasingly journalists are being judged on, you know, how many people are tuning
in. The audience.
Yeah, and it's become increasingly measurable too. I mean, the area that I particularly lecture in is online journalism, and we do look week in, week out at the students' work that they post live on the Circular, and we see, you know, what stories are getting the highest levels of coverage. And quite often there are stories that maybe aren't quite as serious as some of the better journalistic stuff or the better investigative journalism work, and those are sometimes the stories that people hone in on. But crucially, there is demand for good investigative journalism, for good analysis. And I think that was the point that was made. In this case, there's been very little decent analysis. It's just been pure speculation. And it's trying to get not just student journalists, but I think journalists in question. And actually what we saw in the US on the networks was journalists, not only just from different shows, but on the same shows, fighting with each other about the way they were actually reporting on this story and actually calling each other out and saying, you cannot speculate that a UFO was involved here or that there's a Bermuda Triangle or, you know, and this was what was happening. And you had anchors literally arguing with anchors saying, you simply can't say that. That's irresponsible and it's not journalism. So I think there's a level of responsibility that needs to be sort of honed in on, and also genuinely asking the question, what are you adding? Are you adding any value and any benefit to the story? Because really, after 48 hours, for the last 3 weeks, we're none the wiser. We don't know anymore. And really, the story should be put to one side. It should still be covered. We need updates. But this 24/7 idea of it is just, it shouldn't be there.
Yeah, you figure you would put it in the same category as Madeleine McCann.
Yeah, particularly in terms of the idea of disappearance. So, you know, there's something, I remember when that story broke, it's the not knowing. It's, you know, whenever anyone disappears, be it an individual or a group of people, and we don't know what's happened, we do crave closure. We crave wanting to know what's happened. And, I mean, the Oscar Pistorius case is interesting because it is getting a lot of coverage, but crucially, there are loads of people there. There are loads of journalists who are in the courtroom, and we know we're going to get an end case. There's going to be an end to that story. We don't have that in the Malaysian Airlines story. We still don't have it in the Madeleine McCann story. So I think missing, when people go missing, it unfortunately really suits the 24/7 news cycle, because that's what they want. They want something that will just run and run and run and run.
Yeah, the interesting thing about the Pistorius story is that it's gone around the world, again gone around the world. And I wonder, is that because he was a Blade Runner? Like, if he had been in a so-called ordinary...
No, it's a simple story. He's a fallen hero, basically. I mean, the man has overcome adversity.
Yes.
Taken part in the Olympics, but he's a fatal flaw, obviously. Well, allegedly a fatal flaw.
Yeah.
Won't prejudge it, but obviously he admits firing the shots. So it's the sense of the fallen hero, and that here's somebody that's come crashing down to earth, and the public just like that sort of mixture of, you know, somebody's on the pedestal and now they're not.
Yeah, pedestals are very dangerous places.
And in South Africa, he and his his former partner were both bona fide celebrities. They were as well known as any celebrity couple here or elsewhere. So the similarities between that and the O.J. Simpson trial are unmistakable.
It is, they are very... Because O.J. as well was somebody that was on a pedestal, celebrity, greatly admired and all that kind of thing.
And the circumstances are similar in terms of the victim in the case was the wife or the former partner of the person. And I think, again, it is the fallen hero narrative. And
then there's the drama of a courtroom, like a courtroom drama. How many series have we had on courtroom dramas?
And I think it's definitely an example of where social media can play a huge role in a story like this. You know, the fact that literally sentence by sentence you can get Twitter updates on what's going on inside a courtroom, and you can find out literally as it happens what's going on. That adds an awful lot more. I mean, that wasn't there when we had the O.J. Simpson case. It's a new dimension, and it means that you can follow this not just on a TV, but in lots of different ways.
Are you following it?
Not intently, but it's hard to get away from it. You know, when you follow thousands of people on a social network, inevitably it's going to come up. And certainly I know that sort of news organisations are using not just Twitter, but other social networks to keep track of this and to see what journalists who are there are reporting on and people who are in the courtroom. So it can be a very useful source in a case like this.
Mm. Do you follow it?
I have been following it. I can't say I've been assiduously following it. I mean, I think it's a fascinating story because she was such a lovely, good-looking woman, and you know, they were obviously the golden couple.
Yeah.
And apparently he obviously has some fatal flaw in his character because, you know, he decides to open fire through the door of the bathroom. But I have been following it, but as I say, not forensically, I think is the word.
Harry,
I've been following a kind of high profile trial here, but it hasn't. We haven't gone into the whole Twitter feed mentality with our court cases yet. I'm not quite so sure if it's a good thing. In a way, it's good to get lots of new information on an unfiltered basis, but you kind of wonder sometimes you do need somebody who's authoritative, or a person who does this as a living, like a court reporter, who's able to try to present the facts. in as objective way as possible. I do notice, for example, in the Oscar Pretorius trial, that some of the Twitter feeds will come from people who are either supporters or antagonists to him. And sometimes the coverage, especially on social media, will come with a very big health warning. But, you know, it's quite interesting. And the reason why there's such interest in the case, one of the reasons why, is because of the level of access that's been granted. I mean, television cameras going into the courtroom, that kind of unfettered coverage.
Yeah, makes life difficult for print journalists, doesn't it?
Slightly, but it hasn't been introduced here. So I think print is and television, the 6 and 9, the traditional outlets are still the primary media here. That might change over the next 10 or 20 years. But I think there's an attraction to that type of coverage on the one hand, but there are also some difficulties and some dangers as well. I think people should recognise that.
I think there would be major dangers if you had TV cameras in courtrooms, because I think
you'd grandstanding.
Have absolutely, you'd have total grandstanding. There'd be people completely overplaying their card, and either lawyers or whatever, defendants or even prosecuting Gardaí or something. You know, I just think the TV cameras itself, you can understand the principle of doing it, but you can see the dangers of it as well.
Yeah, radio might be more appropriate for it.
Yeah, I think coming back to that idea, though, of the people in the courtroom who are tweeting about it and them being pro and anti, I think there's huge opportunities for journalists and media organisations, and particularly, I suppose, student journalists now who are graduating soon, to get into the area of verification. You know, we're seeing a huge, like Storyful are one example, Mark Little's company, of a company who literally have an awful lot of their work coming through traditional news organizations who want verified facts. And they want to know, for example, if 100 people are in the courtroom tweeting, who's the one authoritative voice? Who is the unbiased voice? So, you know, I absolutely agree. You know, you can definitely follow certain people on social networks and get a very biased view of a court case or any news story. But there's, as I say, there's tremendous opportunity too for third parties to come in, verify that content, and then make it available to your traditional 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock news.
Right. Okay. Well, the fact that it may be criticised, I'd say, doesn't mean that it's going to go away. You know, I don't think so. As we hear about every piece of rubbish or whatever is coming up to the water. I've got a lot of stuff in yesterday from somebody who goes to sea a lot, saying that the seas are absolutely full of rubbish and plastics and all those kind of things. So anyway, we will leave it there for the moment and we'll take a break.
1850 715 150.